Carolina.
No one could be sweeter than MacReady when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. Today, I'll be reading the last chapter from Your Head is a Storehouse, Memoirs by George Winder Thompson, about his life in rural Orange County. And I'll begin reading excerpts from Heaven for Beginners by Betsy Holloway about her life in Durham. Chapter 12, When the Bell Rung. Well, time moved on, and I had grown older, round 20 or 22. I met and talked to a whole lot of girls that I had gone to school with. They were very friendly, but they lived so far away that I didn't get to see them that often. But when I went to church, I would meet other girls, and I enjoyed talking to them. One Sunday, I went to a holiness church. It was right down the road from my home, where Corbett Ridge Road is now. I met this young lady. Her brother, George Thomas, had brought her to church that day. I believe that I had seen her around with her friend, her first cousin, a few times at associations and other churches. It must have been a special occasion that Sunday, because everybody was invited to eat after service. As I recall, we were both leaving out the church at the same time, and I struck up a conversation with her. We walked around the church, talking, and then we ate, and after we ate, I said, "Well, I'd like to see you again, but I know it'll be some time before I can. I bet you live a long way from here. I live right up the road here." She said, "I'll bet I'll be home before you get home." "What? Where do you live?" I said. "About 3 miles down 49. "Well, if it's all right, I'll see you next Sunday." She said, "Okay, I'll see you then." From that meeting, I really looked at her. I knew she could be my cup of tea. I liked her appearance and her ways. She was dressed so nice and talked so well. My heart accepted her that day. As time went on, we visited and talked more. Then joy came, then love came, and then understanding. I dreamed that we would be married, and sure enough, on November 8, 1945, I married Ira Bell Vinson. Bell is what I called her. She belonged to Union Grove Missionary Baptist Church, and her parents and most of her family belonged there too. I didn't belong to a church at that time. You see, as I said earlier, I was born and raised by Primitive Baptists, and I thought I would join that belief. I would try to pray, but I did not know and understand the power of prayer at that time. I did believe in the gospel, and I did believe there was a God. I mean, my parents taught me to read the Bible, and they quoted scriptures. "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you." And there was this one scripture that I would never forget them telling me. "In hope of eternal life, which God, that cannot lie, promised before the world came." Titus chapter 1, verse 2. I think the smartest thing that I learned from my parents was to obey your father and mother. But I just had mixed emotions about church, so I decided to wait until I reached a ripe old age to join. I was not focused on Christ and the church. For one thing, I loved a good movie. I mean, I loved Westerns. I would stay at the movies just about all the time, especially on weekends. Every Saturday night I was at the movies. Even when I didn't have a way, I'd catch someone and borrow money from Mama to go. I always had an old model car before I married, but at that time I had to use Mama's car. Mama always had a nice car, a Chevrolet to boot. Belle would always say to me, "George, you're spending too much time at the movies, and I don't think the Lord is pleased at how much time and attention you give to the movies." Belle started praying that I would stop going to the movies so much and start going to church more. She and her mother both prayed that I would join Union Grove. Well, on this particular Saturday night, as I sat upstairs in the loft of the theater, that's where blacks were required to sit, I had gotten my box of popcorn, leaned back in my chair, getting ready to eat and drink my Coca-Cola and watch Roy Rogers, Hopalong Cassidy, and Gene Autry, when I heard my wife, just as clear, calling my name. George! George! I looked around, and there was no bell. I immediately lost my appetite and left the theater, and when I left that night, I never went back. I talked to the preacher, Reverend Eulus Shavius, about that, and he said, God was calling you, son, and it'll be wise to obey him. Ira Bell's and Mrs. Vinson's prayers concerning me and church were answered too. Church was held only once a month back then, but members held prayer meetings every Sunday night, and it would go from house to house. This particular Sunday, the prayer meeting was at my father's-in-law, James Vinson's home. When it came time for the invitation to give your life to Christ, I got behind some of the people in the back. Most of the people there, who was my age, had already joined the church, so I knew they would be looking for me to come up to sit on the mourner's bench. At church, unlike at somebody's house, the mourner's bench was the first pew reserved for new members. At someone's home, the mourner's bench was the seats up front reserved for those who would give their life to Christ. Reverend Eulus Shavius, the Union Grove pastor at that time, gave the invitation. He usually extended it twice, but that night he said, Tonight I got the feeling there's somebody who wants to accept Christ as their Savior. So he extended the invitation a third time. Anybody want to give their life to Christ? This is your time, he said. And the people started singing another verse of the song. I started praying to the Lord. I don't remember being bad, never killed nobody. I go to church. But I heard him say, You may not have done no harm, but there are two roads, one narrow and one broad, and you're traveling on the broad road, the wrong road, and this is your time. I don't know what happened, but I got up and went to the front of the room and gave my life to Christ. I was baptized at Union Grove Baptist Church in Hurdle Mills, North Carolina, the very next third Sunday. I started serving in the church, and since that time I've been an usher, Sunday school teacher, deacon, superintendent, and recently retired as deacon emeritus. Seemed like right after I joined the church, for a while, I didn't know what was happening. I started being called and treated like everything except a child of God. A lot of it was directed toward our children. We were having children so fast, and people made wisecracks about our having so many. Bell, you got 'em so clean they shine. What do you do to keep them from jumping on your beds all the time? Has any of 'em ever fell out of your car? Winder, we have television now, so you don't need to take your children to church every Sunday. Let 'em stay home and watch television. Television came on the scene around 1946, but many of us didn't own them until the 50s, but Bell's parents did. So we took the children to Mrs. Vinson's to watch television. But I didn't want them missing Sunday school to stay home and watch television. We swallowed a lot of criticism, but I'm so glad God guided my life then, and I haven't found any fault in Him yet. I have lost my Bell, but we had 53 years together. She was my rock. She passed in 1999, but she didn't leave me alone. We had 9 children, and her spirit lives in them, my grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and me. Through teaching our children to overcome trials and tribulations, ignore negative criticism, continue to love those that will treat you wrong, and stay focused on God and His wisdom to guide you, I would like to say that today my oldest son is a certified quality engineer at Continental and was vice president of quality assurance at American Electronic Components. My oldest daughter is professor emeritus at Elon University and has taken students to study abroad in Africa. My second son became a supervisor for the United States Postal Services after a tour of duty in the U.S. Army. My second oldest daughter held a very high position as finance manager at General Motors. She was the accountant on the team that won the GM Chairman Award, the highest honor that GM gives employees. My third daughter works for one of the largest banks in the nation and now is the vice president of global corporate investment for Bank of America. My baby son has retired from his job at GM and became an office manager for Hall Machine and Tool Division and currently owns his home-based business. My fourth daughter is the first female African-American IT manager at the Department of Justice and currently serves as a project manager. And my baby has graduated from college and has written her first book. She is program director at an adult day center. Most of all, my third son, who is my prodigal, returned home safe. I thank God and give him all the glory and praise, for he has kept me these 93 years. At my 90th birthday party, I said to friends and family, and I feel the same way today, I try to owe no man nothing. Just about all of my wants, needs, and dreams have all been met. God has been really good to me. I'm in pretty good health and in my right mind. So when God says, "Welcome, my good and faithful servant," that'll be just fine with me, even though I appreciate all the time he'll give me. Epilogue. My goal from the beginning was to stir up the memory of what older people already had in their heads and leave it for the younger generation, the ways we did things. But I waited so long that many of the older people have gone on, so I had to pretty much recall from my own storehouse what was done back when I was growing up in the 20s and 30s in rural northern Orange County of North Carolina. I mixed in a lot of stories as I was telling about the things we used and the things we did. I hope young people can still catch a glimpse of what life was like during the horse and buggy days, and even though they have far better opportunities to advance with all the modern changes and technology, I hope they will always hold on to the good in our old ways, like being neighborly in the community, being obedient to authority and the elderly, families sticking together, and loving to learn and having wholesome fun. Most of all, young people need to know that we made it through those tough years by making God our foundation and the cornerstone of our lives. In her book, Heaven for Beginners, Betsy Holloway relates some of the history of Durham and history of her mother and father. Beginning in Chapter 2, she relates her own history growing up in Durham. We'll join her there. The walls were strong. North of Main Street, beginning at the Coca-Cola bottling plant and running alongside the eastern border of the stone wall enclosing the Women's College, lay Buchanan Boulevard, for its first 7 blocks a street of large and dignified old two-story houses, adorned variously with columns, porticos, and generous porches, and guarded by sweet gums, maples, and oaks. After the campus wall turned abruptly west on Markham Avenue, Buchanan continued 4 blocks further north until it crossed Club Boulevard and passed open land to become Guess Road. But with the elevating college influence removed, the houses on those remaining 4 blocks became smaller, cozier, and more restrained in design. Exactly halfway between Markham Avenue and Club Boulevard stood our house, on property that had previously held an old brick and frame dwelling where my mother and her parents had lived briefly when they first moved to Durham. 16 years later, after my parents had married and decided to build on the lot, the older house was torn down. The wood was thriftily saved to build a house on my grandparents' farm. Unfortunately, some long-resident roaches remained in the dirt next to what became our half-basement, and no matter how immaculately my mother kept house thereafter, she could never completely drive out the bugs that held earlier title. Periodically, therefore, an exploring roach would find his way into the house, heralded by my anguished screams. Frozen with fear as I was, I could never summon up nerve enough to swat the intruder. So if my mother weren't around to kill him, the roach ran free, if unnerved by the uproar. My parents had built our house midway during the Depression, borrowing $4,500 from the bank to pay for the construction, and reducing costs by using lumber cut from my grandparents' farm for the framing, rafters, and sills. A local carpenter directed the building, but each afternoon, around 3, after my father had finished his work day for Durham Public Service, he and my grandfather went over to labor until dark on the new house. When the building was completed in September, my parents and grandparents moved in together, enjoying, for the first time, the luxury of living in a dwelling that boasted indoor plumbing, a coal furnace, and radiators instead of fireplaces, a closet in each bedroom, and a new electric stove and refrigerator to replace the old wood stove and icebox. Soon, too, a wringer washer would appear in the basement, eliminating the need for boiling clothes in iron pots over a fire. Our house was a Tudor-styled brick cottage, solidly built according to my father's and grandfather's exacting specifications, and large enough by middle-class standards of the day that visitors stopped by throughout its construction. The rooms were small, but we had three bedrooms and a bath, living and dining rooms, a sun parlor, a kitchen with separate pantry and breakfast room, a covered side porch, a small screened back porch, and an attic and basement. A brick garage that held our 1934 Plymouth, with room to spare, stood behind the backyard. Between the garage and our garden ran the alley, a quiet path on which one could walk safely and usually unnoticed all the way through the block to B Street, stealing casual glances into the neighbors' backyards on the way. I liked our address. Buchanan Boulevard sounded dignified and grand, and in fact the house itself always seemed impressive to me, not so much on account of its size as because its elevation was well above street level, so that you had to climb two flights of brick steps, followed by a short walkway, to reach the front door. I loved the house with its substantial-looking brick exterior, its handsome wood floors, cheerful sun parlor, and pretty blue-tiled bathroom that could never be locked because we'd once had a nervous young roomer who had shut herself securely in and then fainted. Alarmed by the incident, my mother had within the week persuaded my father to remove the lock. Only one flaw marred my paradise. I lived in terror of the living room chandelier. That wasn't because I feared the fixture might fall, but because I was certain it was evil, the dwelling place of some nameless but powerful menace that threatened only me. Furthermore, it managed magically to conceal its wicked nature under an entirely ordinary, innocent-looking appearance. It was, in fact, disarmingly attractive in a typical 1930s style, moderate-sized, with a bronze center that was surrounded by five opaque, pale-green, flower-bordered glass shades. How I'd first become aware that the fixture was evil, I have no idea. Perhaps a long-forgotten dream had warned me, or maybe my knowledge had arisen spontaneously out of some long-standing amorphous unease. But evil it was. That was how it happened that, for several years, I avoided going through the living room alone. Somehow I'd divined that the chandelier held no danger for me if someone else were present. Thus, if I needed to go from the dining room to the mailbox at the front, a journey of no more than 20 feet for the ordinary unimperiled person, I went back through the kitchen and out the kitchen door to walk all the way across the backyard, down the length of the house, across the front yard, and finally up the flight of steps leading to the front door. This route was awkward and inefficient at best, especially when it was raining, and inevitably occasions rose when I was absolutely obliged to cross the living room. At such times, I took a deep breath, averted my eyes, and dashed through the room at full speed. This aberrant behavior continued for several years, to the considerable wonderment and concern of my parents, who nevertheless spared my feelings by remaining tactfully silent. Eventually, time solved the problem. The light fixture's power gradually declined, while simultaneously my panic faded. And finally, by the time I was 12, I was able to saunter carelessly through the living room, casting an insouciant, though still watchful, glance at the chandelier as I crossed the room at a recklessly slow pace. Besides the menacing fixture, the living room held our radio, which towered a foot or so above me when I sat in front of it, listening to Jack Benny and Phil Harris on Sunday evenings. Over the mantel hung a framed calendar reproduction of Maxfield Parrish's enigmatic Daybreak. In front of the fireplace stood a card table picturing a splendid clipper ship under full sail. because of the tirelessly constant wood-fetching that had marked my parents' farm childhoods, only the coldest nights brought our fireplace into use. Our built-in bookcase held a thick green leatherette volume authoritatively titled The Modern Home Physician, together with a biography of Will Rogers, a red cloth-bound Hiawatha, Charles Lindbergh's We, and cellophane-bonded pocketbook editions of Chicken Every Sunday, Ernie Pyle's Here Is Your War, and, somewhat inexplicably, and probably left by a rumor, Gabriel Chevalier's racy Scandals of Clochamerle. Our family Bible stayed not in the bookcase, but on a nearby table, for easy access. From a door-to-door salesman, we had acquired a bright blue volume entitled Children, a tedious religious publication that I tried for years, but without success, to read. And we also had a paper-bound Dr. Pierce's Dream Book, from which I learned that dreaming of bees prefigured success in business, and that Dr. Pierce's pleasant pellets provided a peerless remedy for gas. My parents had thought their bookcase unusually generous in size when they built the house, but then they hadn't expected to produce a child who accumulated books with such reckless abandon. Through the years, our shelves slowly filled and overflowed with chronicles of the Bobbsey twins and Nancy Drew, who later on found themselves uneasily sharing their space with E.E. Cummings, Samuel Beckett, and the Palm Wine Drinkard. By the time I finished college, books had proliferated onto every flat surface in the living room, from whence they'd proceeded to stake out several locations in my bedroom. At last it became clear that our only hope of regaining a grip on this unruly word hoard lay in a move to larger quarters. As matters stood, prospects for order looked dimmer by the day. Beside the bookcase was the easy chair where my father sat each evening after dinner to read the Herald. Sometimes, after he'd finished his newspaper, I begged for shadow pictures, whereupon he would obligingly produce on the wall a dog, a donkey, a rabbit wiggling its ears. Other times he grasped me by my ankles and lifted me high into the air while I confidently held my knees stiff and straight and reached for the ceiling. Finally, though, an evening came when, as he started to lift me, my legs crumpled and I clutched anxiously at his shoulders for safety. Understanding, he held me close for a moment before telling me sadly, "I can't lift you any more." Years later, I arrived home from school one afternoon to find him not working in the yard, as was his custom, but sitting motionless in his easy chair, feverish and ill with a kidney infection. A blanket covered him from shoulder to toe, but mine was the deeper chill. We had our family meals in the breakfast room, where a brightly colored oilcloth covered the table that stood across from our Frigidaire. With their southern exposure, the windows in that room were perfect for growing plants, and a row of African violets usually lined the sills. The dining room was for dressed-up company entertaining of the sort that required an embroidered white tablecloth and matching napkins, together with our flowered china, heavy silver, and Indian tree crystal. Also in the dining room stood our black upright piano, a gift from my grandfather to my mother in exchange for her solemn promise to eschew snuff. On the piano's music rack rested a Cokesbury hymnal and my John Thompson lesson books, along with Don't Fence Me In and The Lamplighter's Serenade and Drowsy Moon from a piano recital. Hanging above the buffet were the two colorful still lifes of fruit that my grandmother had received years before as dividends with purchases of cloverine salve. Because she and my grandfather owned no pictures other than a few family photographs, the prints had been her pride. Ennobled by the ornate frames she had somehow managed to acquire for them, they had accompanied her during the move from the farm into town, and then, 18 years later, into this, her last home. On the spattered linoleum floor of our kitchen stood a large cushioned oak rocker, where my mother sat to cap strawberries, peel peaches, and shell beans. The chair stayed in front of a cabinet that contained not one, but two conveniently built-in ironing boards, one of standard size for shirts and dresses, and a smaller one for sleeves. Despite my fondness for this built-in luxury that I considered one of the glories of our house, I usually stayed warily away from the board itself, because once, when my mother had momentarily turned away from ironing, I jerked inquisitively at the cord and pulled the hot iron down upon my foot, causing a painful burn that took weeks to heal. Along with this distasteful memory, the prospect of fire always frightened me, and my fears reached a fever pitch when Mary came in to help with an accumulation of ironing. Mary had an alarming habit of occasionally resting her hot iron on the cloth-padded board rather than on the metal holder, and each time she did, I envisioned hideous ruin and combustion. The cloth pad began to smolder, then ignited, then set our house instantly ablaze. Flames 20 feet high engulfed the brick walls, crackling dreadfully and parching my skin, taking my breath with their heat. Tormented by my horrible imaginings, I fretted long and anxiously over whether I should maintain an uneasy vigil over events in the kitchen, or leave the room gracefully and try to forget the whole thing. Since I was incapable of doing the latter, I finally mustered up nerve enough to mention the peril of her practice to Mary, who for some 30 years had ironed skillfully, uneventfully, and without benefit of my advice. On hearing my stammered, awkward hint, she regarded me amiably, meanwhile resting her hot iron on the board, and advised, "Child, don't trouble yourself about things that ain't going to happen." After that, I worried in silence. Next to the stove stood my grandmother's straight oak chair, where, one summer afternoon, while my mother napped, I decided to cut my hair. Thereupon I sat down, grasped the scissors firmly, and cut methodically for several minutes, one side only, but in some spots practically to the scalp. When my mother rose from her nap to view the result, she wept for the rest of the day. That evening I suffered the indignity of having the rest of my hair shorn in a futile attempt to match the part I'd cut. And ever after, whenever I complained that one side of my hair wouldn't behave properly, I received a gentle reminder about the time I'd cropped it so mercilessly. On the other side of the stove hung a string of dried red peppers. Next to the peppers, an omniscient Fidelity Bank calendar predicted the weather for each day of the year, indicated the moon's phases for planting, and showed the signs of the zodiac. When I became older, I erred in having a wisdom tooth extracted without first consulting the bank's oracle to discover the sign, which turned out to be in the head. For my negligence, I developed a dry socket, missed 3 semester exams, and suffered miserably for a week.
Nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina in a ha 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 in Carolina. No one could be sweeter than the sweetie when I'm in Carolina. Ma-ha-ha-ha-ning.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.